Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Healthcare Committee. It is May 4th, and welcome, everyone. I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2546.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2546A defines inhale and delivery system. It amends the laws relating to the sale of tobacco products to and the use of tobacco products by minors. It adds inhalant to the Oregon Clean Air Act and defines inhalant. It allows healthcare facilities to allow inhalant delivery systems on site for the purpose of administering medical marijuana. There's a -A30 amendment which extends implementation of the Clean Indoor Air Act application to inhalant delivery systems January 1st, 2016. There's a minimal revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. Work session.
Madam Chair, I move the A30 amendments to House Bill 2546A.
Senator Shields moves the A30 amendments into House Bill 2546. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm appreciative of this amendment. I was a little uncomfortable with giving such a cliff to what are essentially small business owners who are involved in this line of work. I think this amendment makes everybody equally unhappy, and therefore I think it's a pretty decent compromise.
Thank you. Any opposition? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2546A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves House Bill 2546A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Am I excused?
Or no, you're not.
Yes, you're excused.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Steiner Hayward will carry the bill, and I will close the bill. Close on the floor, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2546A. And open a work session on House Bill 3041.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3041 directs school districts to allow students to wear sun protective clothing and sunscreen. It specifies that non-prescription sunscreen is not a medication. There's a -3 amendment which clarifies the application of non-prescription sunscreen does not require documentation from licensed professionals and may contain para-aminobenzoic acid. It removes the directive to school boards to adopt policies relating to non-prescription sunscreen and sun protective clothing. It specifies that nothing prohibits a school district from prohibiting certain hats or clothing based on inappropriate things. And school personnel are not required to assist students in applying sunscreen, and clarifies that school personnel may not be held liable for sunscreen that contains para-aminobenzoic acid. It has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
And for the audience, these are bills we've already heard, and we're only working them, so that's why we're hurrying through them, because we just needed the paperwork. So, work session.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 3041.
Senator Cruz moves the -3 amendment into House Bill 3041. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3041 as amended by the -3 amendment to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3041 as amended with the -3s to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and it looks like Senator Johnson. I guess there could be any one of us, but Senator Johnson will carry
Johnson.
I will close the work session on House Bill 3041 and open a public hearing on how.
Matt McClain's here for
31. Oh, good. Open a public hearing on 3149.
And Madam Chair, I'm good to go.
Yes, you're good
okay,
to go.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad you're here, Representative Wisniewski, because I thought Representative McClain, right? Yeah, McClain was supposed to be here, but.
Madam Chair, Representative McClain is on the floor of the House and probably will be till dark.
I know.
And since this bill, he asked me to present this bill to you, it's actually a regarding a constituent of both Representative McLean and mine.
Great.
So for the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, representing Klamath, Crook, most of Lake Deschutes and Jackson counties. House Bill 3149 is designed to fix a unintended problem, I believe. Under current Oregon law, medical orders must be submitted to public or private schools by an in-state physician within 90 days in order for a registered nurse to begin treating a child enrolled at school. This provision causes significant hardship for families who have recently moved to Oregon and have not been able to obtain an appointment with a physician qualified to issue such an order. For instance, a constituent returned to Oregon from Maryland just in time to enroll their children in school. Their medical records and medical orders were from Johns Hopkins University Diabetic Clinic. These records were legally insufficient to allow the school nurse to administer necessary medications. Living in a rural community, it required nearly 3 months to obtain an appointment to receive an Oregon legal medical order. House Bill 3149 simply extends the period of time for an out-of-state medical order to be valid to 90 days. This should enable most families to obtain their medical orders that they need to keep their children in school activities. That's the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Is the Board of Nursing here at all? If they had any problems with the bill, I assume that they would have submitted testimony, and obviously they didn't submit any testimony on the House. Anyone else who would like to testify in House Bill 3149? Going twice? All right. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3149 and open a work session on House Bill 3149.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3149 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carries, and Representative Whitman, would you carry the...
He's a senator.
Senator. Sorry, Senator. It's your wife I was thinking of.
Thank you very much. Yes, right. I'd be happy to carry.
All right.
Thank you.
Note that for the record, and we will close the work session on House Bill 3041. And colleagues, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 631. And I love all of the red shirts out there with health care as a human right. You're absolutely 100% correct in my eyes. We do have some panels, and Zena, would you just please explain the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 631 creates the Health Care for All Oregon Board to develop, implement, and have oversight over the Health Care for All Oregon Plan under the Oregon Health Authority. It provides comprehensive health care coverage to individuals residing or working in Oregon. It directs the Public Employees Benefit Board and Oregon Educators Benefit Board to offer supplemental health benefit plans to employees and requires public employees to be covered by the Health Care for All Oregon Plan. It establishes the Health Care for All Oregon Fund and establishes the Office of Health Care for All Oregon Ombudsman. It requires the board to establish regional planning boards to oversee the allocation of resources in designated regions determined by the board. It requires the regional planning board to approve construction of health care facilities apart with the exception of long-term care facilities. It authorizes the Department of Human Services to approve certificate of need for long-term care facilities and eliminates the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no amendment, and fiscal and revenue statements have not been issued.
Great. Now, Senator Denbro did want to introduce this, but do you want to say a few words, Senator Shields?
Sure. Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity. I think that if there's one thing that I've learned struggling with these issues, I think that this is an idea that we should pursue. I think that incrementally we have long-term goals and short-term goals to try to improve the quality of health care in this state, and I think this is a very worthy goal, that one that we should continue to pursue.
Thank you. And if Senator Denbrough is out there, we're going to start with the rest of the panels, but we will stop when you get here. All right. Charlie Swanson, is it Jason Freelinger and Paul Huckfield?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair and members of the committee, I'm Charlie Swanson, and I am a member of Healthcare for All Oregon from Eugene. I'm part of a team that helped to write Senate Bill 631, which is a revision of a bill that was introduced in the House in the 2013 session. And it establishes universal, comprehensive, publicly funded healthcare in Oregon. I'm going to give an overview of what the problem is, how this bill will help, and what are the next steps. A major problem is that healthcare costs have been rising rapidly for a long time. This chart shows healthcare costs projected for a decade into the future, and with that projection from 1991 to 2025, we expect that healthcare costs will have risen 50% more than the Oregon economy. All categories of healthcare have risen faster than inflation, than wages, and than per capita income. Prescription drugs have risen faster than anything else, but healthcare administration has also risen very rapidly. This increase in healthcare costs has created hardships and disasters for individuals and families. It's estimated that at least 600 Oregonians die, and at least 8,000 Oregonians go bankrupt each year due to economic barriers to health care. This chart shows why being covered, that is, having insurance, is not enough. This shows the percentage of households that are unable to pay the rising deductibles and co-pays. It's especially hard for those who are slightly above poverty level but not quite eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. These rising costs have also created hardships for state agencies, for government. Because a rising share of all spending goes towards health care, there's less left for everything else. It's also impacted private employers. Even with employees picking up a larger share of their health care costs, the rising cost to business has meant their profitability has shrunk and they have less money to reinvest. Oregon's been a leader in moving towards more universal coverage and trying to control health care costs for some time. This act will continue Oregon's leadership. The act will actually need more stakeholder input to define a system that's ready for implementation.
Senator Denbrough is here. Should we let him finish, or do you want to just say a few words so you can get to wherever you need to be?
No, he can finish, and then I'll finish.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The purpose of the act, and I'll just read the purpose, is to ensure access to comprehensive, quality, patient-centered, and affordable, publicly funded health care for all Oregonians, to improve population health, and to control the cost of health care for the benefit of individuals, families, business, and society. The bill will cover all people residing in Oregon or working in Oregon. All people who are in Oregon are currently covered for acute emergency room care. That's a legal, ethical, and moral imperative. But it's also expensive. This bill would broaden coverage to other sorts of care. It could prevent many of these emergency room visits and better maintain health. A major theme of this bill is to simplify administration. It will do this because it will be universal. It will cover everybody in Oregon. It will cover all medically necessary services, so it's comprehensive. It will be single payer. There will be the same payments for the same services. There will be no copays and deductibles. We'll also have flexible payment systems, which are may be tailored to each provider to best meet the needs of the providers, the patients, and the system. These payment systems might include global budgets, fee-for-service, and other transparent and fair systems as needed. And we expect that these will be able to create the best incentives for appropriate and efficient care. This chart speaks for itself. In red is the number of healthcare administrators, the growth in healthcare administration, and in blue the number of physicians, the growth in physicians. The number of administrators has gone 15 times more in the last three decades than the number of physicians. In general, administrative simplicity will lead to greater equity. For this bill, there will be all residents will be covered equally and all services will be covered equitably. Providers will be able to treat all patients the same and know that their services are covered. There will be no difference between those covered by private insurance, by Medicare, or by the Oregon Health Plan. This bill also addresses an issue with urban and rural equity. It defines regional planning boards to continually look at the conflict between providing sufficient services in rural areas and controlling system cost. It largely replaces the Certificates of Need program. There may be other issues, geographically related issues, that can be addressed by the regional planning boards. Usually, increased equity will also lead to increased efficiency and lower costs. But sometimes, as in this case, the increased equity will actually lead to slightly higher costs, but it's still worth it. Oregon will not be alone. Every other industrialized country in the world has a system similar to this bill. There are many other states that are moving in this direction also. What are the next steps? In this session, the most important step to moving towards controlling health care costs is to fund the study of health care financing that was authorized in the 2013 session. In particular, to pass House Bill 2828 with funding. This study will give us guidance to improving and completing the plan. We'll use the best ideas from this bill, from the 2011 bill that established coordinated care organizations. We'll use information from successful systems worldwide, and we'll engage stakeholders and experts. What can we learn from other countries? Every other country in the world spends less on healthcare than the U.S. The U.S. is over here in red, a lot less than we do. Most other countries have better results than the U.S. This shows female life expectancy at birth with the U.S. in red. Other markers of health care effectiveness would show similar results. What are the benefits of a system as described in this bill? There will be sufficient administrative savings to extend comprehensive services to all. This will greatly improve equity and affordability. The administrative simplicity will help to detect and reduce fraud. We can expand the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to all pharmaceutical purchases in Oregon. This will deal with the portion of healthcare with the largest cost increases. The economic barriers to healthcare leading to death and bankruptcy will be eliminated. We expect that the increased competitiveness of Oregon businesses will lead to 50,000 new jobs, which will more than offset the loss due to decreased healthcare administration. The improved provider payment systems can shift the focus of care toward health promotion, primary care, and prevention, and away from less effective, more expensive later stage treatments. How will this be financed? The healthcare financing study will help to determine that, and the financing details will need input from many stakeholders. We expect the study to show that there is a better financing scheme than currently exists, and we also expect that most people in Oregon will pay less when a universal system is implemented than they would without such a system.
Imagine a future with no healthcare bills. No confusing plans or restrictive networks. It'll be simple. One quality plan for all of us, for our whole lives. We'll be free to have the job we want, not just the job that provides insurance.
No!
We'll be free to see our own doctors and receive the best care for our families when we need it, not just when we can afford it. we won't have to put off seeing the doctor and risk getting sicker. We'll be free to have the care our doctors advise without worrying how we're going to pay. Freedom from financial worry. Freedom to be healthy. Join thousands of Oregon physicians and patients who are working to make it happen. Help us. We can make this real right here in Oregon. Now.
So in summary, the most important action in this session is to continue moving towards healthcare that provides better service with lower cost, is to pass House Bill 2828 with funding, the study bill. We ask that the state and other stakeholders continue to help with planning beyond the study. We can explore negotiations for federal waivers, certifications, and permissions that will be needed to implement this plan. We can perhaps refine the regional planning board concept or find some other method to work towards rural-urban equity in healthcare delivery. Once the study is complete, we can outline a tax structure to finance a universal system that is fair and provides sufficient funding. We can explore incremental steps that are consistent with what we expect will be the nature of a universal system. Among these might be expanding the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to those paying with insurance, or broadening the Oregon Health Plan eligibility. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'll take any questions from the committee.
Why don't you stay there? Let's have Senator Dembro just give his comments, and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair, colleagues. I'm Michael Dembro, and I represent Senate District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland, Park Rose, and Maywood Park. And I really thank you for turning your time and attention to the subject of universal health care in general and Senate Bill 631 in particular. So sorry about coming late. You went faster than I thought you would in the prior things, and then I'll have to go back to my committee. But I wanted to sort of give you the framework for this and just give you a sense of why we need to move in this direction. That was before I saw the video, and so now I'm thinking maybe just let's show that a few more times, because that was remarkably clear. But, of course, I can't resist giving you my comments. Colleagues, there are many good things that we can say about health care reform in this state, and the members of this committee have many reasons to be proud, from the Healthy Care Kids Act in 2009 to the ongoing work on CCOs and state implementation of the Affordable Care Act. The Oregon legislature has been working hard to help create a healthcare system that addresses the triple aim of access, quality, and affordability. Despite these points of progress, though, I and many others are convinced that even under the Affordable Care Act, many long-term problems remain and will remain. First, there will still be many people who will be left out, who for their own reasons will decline to be part of the system, will prefer to pay a penalty, rather than have insurance, but who will eventually need care. And that's going to continue to drive up the cost of coverage for the rest of us. Second, for most people, insurance is still going to be tied to employment. And that connection is distorting how employment is done in this state. The decision on whether to hire people full-time versus part-time is going to be still tied to the question about benefits. And companies are going to make decisions that really are not in their best interests in terms of doing the work that they need to do, but are being done just strictly to meet our antiquated insurance laws. We'll continue to have jobs kept temporary or part-time for no good reason other than to keep workers from being eligible for coverage. And third, for the most part, our system will still rely on private insurance companies, who will continue to charge administrative fees that are unnecessarily high create administrative burdens for doctors and other healthcare professionals, and whose primary obligation is to their stockholders as opposed to the public at large. At best, what we're going to continue to have is an expensive, complicated patchwork system. There's a real danger that people are going to fall through the cracks, that middle-class families are going to pay more, small businesses are going to continue to be hammered, and the state will need to pick up more of the costs at the expense of education and other crucial services. Fortunately, there is a very simple solution out there, a model of publicly funded and privately delivered care that has existed legally and to great effect for the last 50 years in this country, and that's Medicare. Medicare gives us very low administrative fees, gives us individual choice, a high level of care for our most vulnerable and expensive population, and it gives us universal access. What we need to do is to take Medicare, improve it where it needs to be improved, and extend it to the entire population. This is the way that healthcare is provided in virtually every other industrial nation in the world, including our neighbor to the north, Canada, where it was adopted province by province before being extended to the entire nation. That, in a nutshell, is the intention behind Senate Bill 631, the Health Care for All Oregon Act. When adopted, it will move Oregon to a comprehensive health care system with universal access, in which the cost of health care is spread across the entire population of the state and therefore made more affordable. It will disconnect coverage from employment. It'll drive down the overhead costs of Oregon businesses and will attract new business to Oregon. It will drive down the personnel costs of government, allowing us to shift resources to providing the services that Oregonians need. We're very excited to be bringing Senate Bill 631 to the legislature and to the people of Oregon. One of the real problems with the federal reform process in 2009 and 2010 was that advocates of single payer were never allowed a seat at the table. Despite the fact that Medicare is a viable model and many countries around the world have some form of single payer that's working very effectively. For reasons of politics and influence and strategy, it was ruled out before it was even considered. That's wrong. It's bad government, and we need to make it right. Fortunately, the federal health insurance reform did open the door to further experimentation by the states, thanks in large part to work done by Senator Wyden. Starting in 2017, states will have a path to try out their own solutions, as long as they're expanding access to quality health care to more people more affordably. We believe that the affordable health care, that the Health Care Act for All Oregon, will do that. A wide range of physicians, care providers, health care advocates, and other Oregonians have come together to help craft and support this bill. You see many of them in front of you, and you'll hear from some of them today. Obviously, getting to health care for all Oregon is a long-term project. We're under no illusions that it will be easy or quick. I myself believe that it will require a vote of the people. Advocates will need to convince a million voters that Medicare for all, that Medicare for all is right for Oregon. We'll need to make sure that the underlying policy and the mechanics of implementation are right for Oregon. We'll need to look at the research being done in other states, states like Vermont, New Hampshire, and California, and see what can be applied to Oregon. Initial modeling shows that we could take the amount of money that's being spent in Oregon, that's currently being spent in the form of tax credits, premiums, deductibles, copays, other out-of-pocket payments and obligations, use it to fund a system in which the people of this state become one large self-insured pool, and everyone could be covered for that amount of money. But clearly, the devil will be in the details of the administration, in the details of administration, oversight, delivery, and funding. That's why we need to fund House Bill 2828, the Healthcare Funding Study Bill, which will help us figure out the best way to find and fund the best path for getting to universal health care. That's why we need today's hearing, so that you can hear the details, hear the arguments, ask the necessary questions, the questions that are necessary to help us get this right. I want to thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, for scheduling this hearing and for allowing us to pursue this subject that is so crucial to the future of this state.
I think one of the biggest questions I have, of course, when I take a look at the healthcare systems in other parts of the world, they have such a high tax. So, what, 50, 60% of their income goes to the government. And that's why I get a little nervous about a funding mechanism. I think there are some creative ways to come up with some funding mechanisms, but that is my greatest concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I hear you, Madam Chair, but, you know, and certainly we have to look to other countries. Sometimes it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges, right? I mean, if you look at their total, the total tax burden, you also have to look at this, the fact that they don't have to pay money doesn't come out of their salary or out of their employer's income to pay for health care, you know, so their salaries can be higher. You have to look at everything in its totality. But you're absolutely right. You know, we have to, you know, as I said, we have to make sure that the funding system that we have gets it right. Certainly, you know, I think that's why we also need to look at Medicare, the system that we have in this country, and look at what examples it can provide for us.
Right. And Medicare, Part A, covers hospital, but then Part B, we do have to purchase. We pay a premium to the different carriers that are always sending me pamphlets in the mail since I am on Medicare. So in that sense, you're still paying an insurer, mm-hmm. unless we can change the Medicare system so we get rid of that supplemental that most all of us really yeah. need to have.
And presumably that would be rolled into this overall system. That's right.
Thank you. Yeah. Other comments? Thank you very much,
okay,
Senator
Dembrough.
We'll let you get back to your other committee.
Great. Thank you.
Should I stay up here? Or?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Please proceed.
I'm next?
Yep.
I'm Paul Hochfeld. I'm a recently retired emergency physician, and I spent all 35 years at Samaritan Regional Medical Center in the emergency room. And my goal today is to get you to rethink what this is about. And instead of thinking about the single payer, think about the risk pools. Think about a single risk pool. And I'm not coming as a bleeding heart liberal with some socialist agenda. I'm coming as a taxpayer who's really tired of getting ripped off, and as a physician who bristles at the idea that we even have a healthcare system. Because the only thing systematic about it is it's made up of a bunch of economic entities that are trying to profit largely with public money, because 35% or 60% of all of our healthcare dollars, either directly or indirectly, comes from the taxpayer. And we spend, as you know, twice as much as most other developed countries. But what we're really good at this country, better than anybody else, aside from paying a lot for drugs, is we're good at separating our people into risk pools. Nobody does it as good as we do. So let's look at the risk pools. There's old people, and they're covered by Medicare, and old people have high health care costs because a lot of them are going to die soon. And who pays for that? Taxpayer. And then there's disabled people, and they're covered through Medicare, and they're expensive. And who pays for that? The taxpayer. Then there's poor people who get covered by Medicaid, And if you ask Chun Wei Chi or any healthcare authority, they'll tell you that health follows wealth, and sickness follows poverty. So poor people are high risk, they're expensive, and the taxpayer pays for them. And the taxpayer pays for Native Americans who have their own set of problems, and the taxpayer pays for vets, and the taxpayer pays for the military. These are all really expensive people because they've got serious problems, and we really have to pay for them. So what about the rest? They're covered by private health insurance, and they're mostly employed people and their families. And employed people and their families are inherently in a low risk because they're employed and they've got some resources. And their care is subsidized by the taxpayer because employers deduct the cost of health care. And now low-income employees get money through the Affordable Care Act if their income isn't too high. And then we've got the people that fall through the cracks, the people who don't have insurance. And among those are immigrants, legal and otherwise. And when they can't get the care that they need when they need it, and they end up in my emergency room with a bad problem that could have been cared for a lot cheaper earlier, and they end up in the ICU, and they can't pay their bill, then what happens? Well, the hospital loses money on the bill, and we all see higher charges from the hospitals because of bad debt. So we're all paying for them anyway. So the question is, what do we get for slicing and dicing our population into all these different risk pools? Well, we really get a bunch of insurance companies that are profiting from it, insurance companies that are trying to manipulate federal legislation so that they can make more money. And I'm referring to the Affordable Care Act, which does some really good things, undeniably, but has increased administrative costs, undeniably. And basically, what we get for slicing and dicing is it increases total health care costs by about 20%. That's 20% of all of our healthcare dollars that could be going to healthcare, but instead is going into excessive administrative costs because providers have to pay more to collect from these hundreds of insurance companies, all with different sets of rules. And the insurance companies themselves are competing for low-risk populations by, for instance, renaming stadiums. Just saying. So at its core, SB 631 is about ending this sort of ludicrous, counterproductive activity of separating us into all these different risk pools, harnessing the taxpayer with paying for all the high-risk pools, and then telling the taxpayer they have to subsidize the rest of the people so the insurance companies can make money. It's just crazy. So I know there's a lot of fear of more government involvement in healthcare financing, but I think we need to sort of get over it and admit that we're all paying for everybody anyway. We're all paying for everybody anyway. I keep coming back to that. We need to design a system that reflects that reality and put everybody in the same risk pool. And that's what HB 631 does at its core. And 631 is not ready to be passed, I understand, but I would really urge the committee members to work very hard to craft a single risk pool legislation that you can embrace.
Thank you so much. Let's finish the panel and then open it up for questions.
Thank you, Chairperson Mona Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Jason Feilinger. I'm from Silverton, Oregon. I'm a small business owner. I own a electronics and game hobby store, formerly a Radio Shack franchise. So as a small business owner, my wife and I started our business 4 years ago. I had spent 15 years in the corporate world in the telecommunications industry, and I wanted to move on to be my own boss. I knew that medical insurance was going to be an important factor, and I did a lot of research in looking at costs associated with opening a small business and providing insurance for myself and my employees. I, of course, quickly learned that it cost me to pay twice as much for an employee as it cost my former employee, or close to twice as much. Because of that risk pool concept. So I was looking at a much higher expense. Actually, a third of my payroll expenses when I first started 4 years ago went to medical expenses. I was excited about the Affordable Care Act coming. I researched the best way to handle that. And I actually found that the best way to handle that was to not provide my employees with insurance. And I provided a $500 stipend for medical insurance, which they then used to go on to the exchange themselves and buy it themselves. Now, that lowered my cost to 20% of my payroll costs. And quite frankly, it saved me from going out of business and being able to do as well as I am now. So the ACA helped, but we can do better. As a small business employer, I want to provide health care for my employees and their families. Actually, I'm very happy to pay for it, as long as it's fair. But I'm also not a medical professional. I shouldn't be making medical decisions about what type of coverage people need or how best to finance it. And honestly, you put employers in that position under our current system. One of the things was just mentioned about tax rates, and I just want to mention that I already said I pay 20% for health care for my employees. I would be very happy to pay 20% to a government-run organization to take care of this so I didn't have to. Employees want medical insurance, and they want medical insurance that stays with them. They don't want to have to worry about changing doctors as they go from job to job. And I know I have limited time, but I'm going to plug in my story just a little bit here. In 2008, I had a stroke. A stroke of an unusual sort caused specifically by stress. And the doctors essentially said that, I'm not a doctor, but essentially I blew my top due to stress and anxiety related to my job. And I blew out an artery in the back of my neck. For 3 years, I worked through recovery and continued to work on the job that had made me sick. Because I couldn't get insurance anymore. I couldn't get insurance anywhere. And I couldn't afford to go and get insurance. But I worked through that. And luckily, with the help of my wife, we opened a business and we have found our way. Health care for all is very important to small business because we are at a disadvantage. There is a burden on us to take on things. I have two employees and some seasonal part-time employees. I'm not a big employer. My competition have taken their full-time employees and reduced their hours to part-time in order to avoid health care costs through the ACA, basically giving them a competitive advantage against me, wanting to do the right thing by providing insurance for my employees. I think if we go through with this healthcare for all plan, I know it's not fully made up, but go along with the concept, we will attract smart, skilled employees to Oregon because they'll know this is a good place to live. We will also attract businesses that care about their employees because they know that their employees will be taken care of in the state of Oregon healthcare system. I also believe it'll bring positive investment to Oregon as far as growth and economic opportunity. And so for this reason, I ask you to work with us on helping to develop SB 631.
Thank you so much. Questions? The one comment I would like to make that one difference between European or other nations and the United States is also drug costs. And I wish that our federal government would use some guidelines like the European Union does on curbing drug costs. I know that would that would have to be worked out, like you say, the devil's in the details, but there's a huge discrepancy between the price of drugs here in the United States compared to other nations. But thank you.
If we had a single risk pool, the payor would have a tremendous amount of leverage to negotiate drug prices.
True.
Of course, Congress would have to get out of the way and allow Medicare to negotiate for drug prices.
That's right.
That'll get into the campaign financing, and that's not what this is all about.
That's right. Well, thank you very much, panel. Rob Sisk, Penny York, and Joanne Hardesty. I don't see Joanne, so the next one is Nancy Sullivan.
Who wants to go first?
In order.
Sure.
Right to left as we look into our
right to left
TV set.
Okay, please proceed.
Right to left. My name is Nancy Sullivan, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. I'm a retired nurse midwife. Thank you for taking the time today to listen to supporters of universal single-payer health care in Oregon. Those of us who have actively supported this issue, in particular Senate Bill 631, appreciate the opportunity to tell you why we believe that the best solution to our current out-of-control healthcare system is the solution adopted by every other developed country. During my long career as a nurse midwife, I had the opportunity to care for many vulnerable and underserved, meaning uninsured, mothers and babies. This opportunity fell to nurse midwives because this population was not desired or recruited by most physician providers. In truth, in the 1970s, there were not many other opportunities for nurse midwives to practice our profession and to prove that the care we provide is safe, effective, and cost-effective. Over the years, our clientele has expanded and now includes many middle and upper income insured women, including almost 20% of Oregonian women. Nonetheless, my greatest gratification always came from caring for women who may not have had any care otherwise, women affected by poverty, lack of education, immigration status, language barriers, and lack of insurance. In the early 90s, I was the clinical director of Healthy Start, a nonprofit formed by a number of organizations in response to an alarming situation in Washington County. The hospitals there were seeing large numbers of women in labor dropping in to their emergency rooms, having had no or very little prenatal care. It fell on the on-call obstetricians to care for these women, and understandably, they were not happy about it. The Washington County Health Department, Tualatin Hospital, St. Vincent Medical Center, Virginia Garcia Medical Center, and the OHSU Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology got together to find a solution. With a generous contribution from the Meyer Memorial Trust and subsidies from the partner hospitals, Healthy Start, using a midwifery model of care, was born. We served Medicaid patients as well as women who had no insurance. Almost all of the midwives and staff spoke Spanish. A big advantage, ironically, was that Medicaid patients accepted. There were no insurance forms to complete, no deductions to calculate, no copays to collect. Those without insurance were expected to pay in cash on a sliding fee scale ranging from $5 to $50 a visit. In 1993, with the Oregon Health Plan, we lost our Medicaid mothers, the one group for whom we actually broke even. Under OHP, these women became attractive to primary care providers who enrolled them during pregnancy in order to have more young, healthy patients in their practices. With the loss of Medicaid dollars, our need for subsidies for the remaining patients soared, and the program struggled and eventually closed. Virginia Garcia took many of the uninsured patients. St. Vincent maintained and subsidized the Healthy Start operations there and does to this day. This kind of crisis-oriented, on-again, off-again solution to lack of care is common in Oregon as elsewhere. Project Access Now, with volunteer physicians and other providers, attempts to care for many uninsured and unhealthy individuals in the Portland area. Their website states that there are 50,000 such people. I am sure that every well-meaning medical volunteer for this organization would support a healthcare environment in which their volunteer services were no longer needed. Support for universal single-payer healthcare in the United States has been around for decades, but efforts to legislate it into being have been attacked and defeated in every case by heavily funded insurance, pharmaceutical, and hospital industry lobbies. As grassroots volunteers, proponents in Oregon know that our strategy to achieve our goal must be to educate the public and to enlist activist supporters. We believe that the ACA will fall under its own weight at some point. The huge numbers of new enrollees in for-profit and nonprofit and health insurance programs with ever-increasing premiums, deductibles, and copays will be unable to meet these demands. And despite their having insurance, they will be unable to afford health care. They will be faced with the choice of foregoing needed treatment or accruing significant debt in order to get it. Why are we waiting for this almost certain eventuality? Why can't we finally move to assure that Oregonians have access to health care and the freedom from stress that health care provides? Why do we continue to believe that the American way is better when it is twice as expensive and considerably less effective than care in many other countries? Of particular interest to me as a midwife, American maternal mortality rates rose over a 20-year period at a rate that places the U.S. in the company of war-torn countries like Afghanistan and impoverished nations like Chad and Swaziland. We rank 60th from the top in the world for this parameter. Shame on us. The burden of this increased mortality falls not only on poor women without access to care, but also on middle and upper class women who receive too much care, unnecessary cesareans, elective inductions, and so forth. Likewise, our society as a whole is affected by skewed levels of care, too little for some, too much for others. We can do better, and we must do better. Thank you again for your attention.
In the interest of time, I would prefer that you not clap. I know we should clap after everyone, but please proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Penny York. I'm president of the Corvallis City Council. In 2011, the council passed a resolution supporting single-payer option. But I'm speaking here today from the perspective of a mother whose family was devastated by a catastrophic medical event, an event made worse by our country's dependence on employment-based health insurance. In 2009, my 36-year-old daughter, Christy, was head teacher at a local charter school when she was diagnosed with a large tumor pressing on her brainstem. A few hours after apparently successful surgery, she started to bleed in her brain. She spent 3 weeks in intensive care and had three more brain surgeries. Would she live? What would her condition be if she did? My husband addressed the financial issues. Her nonprofit employer extended her health insurance 1 month. How long could we continue to take money from our savings to pay her mortgage? Would she have to declare bankruptcy? After 5 weeks, Christy was able to go to inpatient rehab. Adequate health insurance pays for extensive rehab for brain-injured patients. Her insurance paid only $25,000 total, while the rehab costs were $1,200 a day. So we moved her to a skilled nursing facility. Therapy equipment was inadequate. Her caregivers were overworked. Her therapist had no special training in brain injuries. When I was able to bring Christy home from Corvallis, I did her application for Social Security disability insurance and learned that it would be over 2 years before she would be eligible for Medicare. So For 2.5 years, my husband and I paid all of her medical costs, her private insurance premiums, her co-pays, her assistive equipment that wasn't covered, and during that time, we provided her care until she was able to care for herself. It could have been worse. Christy is walking now without a cane. She just started teaching again part-time. While she has special health care needs and she has long-term disabilities, she's doing well. But it shouldn't be this way. When my husband and I were terrified about losing our only child, he shouldn't have had to spend hours on the phone with an insurance company trying to explain why an out-of-plan neurosurgeon had performed an emergency brain surgery on her one night. Of course, the reason he did that was he was the neurosurgeon on call, and he saved her life, and had he not been there, she would have died. They denied the charge. People with disabilities who are unable to work shouldn't have to wait 2.5 years for Medicare. Medical care should be based on medical need. I urge you to support health care for all Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Rob Sisk, president of SEIU 503 OPEU, and I'm also speaking on behalf of sister local SEIU 49. Together, we represent over 65,000 workers and their families throughout Oregon, with thousands of our members employed in the healthcare field. Not only are these thousands of members directly impacted by the struggles and frustrations of trying to provide care and services within an inefficient system, but over half our members are low income, having to suffer the costs and tenuous outcomes of an unreliable but exorbitantly expensive system. For many years, SEIU, both on the national and the state level, has been advocating for affordable, quality health care for all. Our work has been guided by the conviction that regular access to health care is not just a privilege for those who can comfortably afford it, but a right for all. If access is limited, the economically disadvantaged, so desperately needing both the physical care and the moral support, are not only ignored, but their health issues dangerously worsen, which drives up the cost of health care for all, since neglected conditions require more intensive and prolonged treatment than if they are addressed at earlier stages. SEIU, on a national and state level, has also championed health care that will rein in escalating costs for both public subsidized and privately paid health care. We support strategies and operations and outcomes that put Oregonians first as consumers and taxpayers by creating the most cost-efficient system with the best possible results. Tragically, for what should be a humanitarian-driven system, health care services continue to be exploited by those using it for their own financial interests, the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, and unfortunately, often by what should be the paragon of health care in its most recognizable face, the hospital industry. Executive compensation and profits in all these industries are outrageously high and even immorally high, as these industries have spent nearly $3 billion in the last 15 years lobbying for more tax breaks, tax loopholes, exemptions, protections, and other special privileges, enabling monopolies on high-cost drugs and procedures, excessive fees, and other profit drivers. As a result, health care costs continue to escalate, so even those with insurance plans are left with high premiums, copays, and deductibles. Yet quality and access remains low for many Americans, and not uncommonly with substandard results. A study less than a year ago published in Forbes showed the United States dead last behind 10 other major developed countries in overall health care and in the categories listed. It was second to last in access, last in efficiency, last in equity, and far and away highest in cost. Dr. Russell Andrews, a neurosurgeon and author of the book Too Big to Succeed, a stark revelation of how America is on an unsustainable healthcare course, laments the morphing of American medicine from a function of a humanitarian society into a revenue stream for healthcare profits, drug and medical device companies, hospitals, and insurance companies. In essence, he says, we have transformed healthcare in the U.S. into an industry whose goal is to be profitable. Dr. Andrews goes on to characterize the profit motive as a virus infecting the healthcare system. Even with the Affordable Care Act, the low income and the no income struggle and simply can't pay the costs that are left them. Despite the intentions of ACA, those on the edge who have fallen off do not have full access to care or their care is limited. Insurance companies have found ways to get around the act by minimizing plans and still pushing expenses on to the insured in order to ensure their high profits. Five of the largest healthcare insurers in America made a combined profit of nearly $18 billion in 2014. Dr. Sacken Shaw with Doctors for America states that for insurance companies, their business model is to profit by finding ways to avoid caring for sick people in their time of greatest need. Drug costs continue to be high for many who have no other alternative. Pharmaceutical companies have long since moved from simply making profits to profiteering at the expense of those in dire need of medicine for survival. The top 10 drug companies in the world made a combined profit of $83.33 billion in 2013. In the interest of profits, a majority of hospitals avoid transparency on service costs and outcomes. Hospitals enjoying tax-exempt status as nonprofits avoid the obligation of charity care that should go with that status. Again, in the interest of profits and what should be a model of humanitarian service, costs are as excessive as is executive compensation. Meanwhile, healthcare spending is about 17% of the national economy, or about $3 trillion a year, and is projected to reach 20% of the GDP by 2021. In Oregon, it is significantly more, around $9 billion, or about 22% of our state budget. The necessity for care against the costs escalating nonstop means other parts of our economy and other vital public services are alarmingly underfunded or neglected. Our objective should be obvious. Take the obsession for profit out of healthcare and you put the care back into healthcare. The primary motivation should be to keep Americans healthy and to return Americans to the best health possible as quickly as possible. When we accomplish that, we will profit in so many other ways as well. SEIU is here today because it supports legislation for the system that will do that best. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Any questions? All right. Thank you for your story. Thank you for coming. Dr. Chi, Tim Roach, Ken Myers. Oh, no, Joanne Hardesty, and then Tim Roach.
I'm disappointed Senator Cruz left. I didn't get a chance. Is he coming back?
Yes, he's coming back.
He better. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Joanne Hardesty, and I am here to speak in support of the legislation in front of you. I'm speaking, you have my written testimony. I am also the president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP. But just like a previous speaker, I thought, telling you about my own personal experience trying to get health care, let me start off briefly by saying I worked in coalition with a lot of community-based organizations seeking health care reform. And we started this effort back in 2006, and we thought, okay, here we are. We're going to make this happen. This is going to be real. But what was real was once health care reform was passed at the federal level, as you know, our system here didn't work. And so for people who didn't have insurance, as a small business owner, I thought, I'm going to follow the law. I'm going to go online. I'm going to sign up. Couldn't do it. And so my only option was to go directly to a healthcare provider who, of course, only wanted to give me the perspective of what I could get from that provider. So we signed up. We paid over $1,000 a month just for the privilege of having a card in my wallet. Now, you want to talk about treatment? You go in and see a doctor, there's a copay. Now, the first one, you don't pay for it. But she asked me to come back. They wanted me to pay $70 in copay to come back. I argued, no, I'm not paying $70. You told me to come back. I didn't ask to come back. The point I'm trying to make is I am someone who can read legislation. I'm someone that's helped pass legislation. And even I found it extremely difficult to go to on my own try to figure out how to get health coverage. What I'm hearing from my membership is that there are many people who have cards but no health care. And so you call the provider. Provider says it's going to take 4 months. Poor people are accustomed to hearing that from healthcare providers, so they just don't come back until they are so severely sick that they are forced to come back. The current system that we have is a pretend healthcare system. If you are rich, you can get any care you need at any time you need it. If you are working class, you get put into a queue. So I have a healthcare. I was fortunate. I was given a website that had 728,000 healthcare providers on it and told to pick one as my primary healthcare provider. How does the same person do that? 728,000 names on a database. And so, again, because I'm someone who actually used to reading legislation, used to answering hard questions, I was really challenged. As I talked to my membership, they continue to be challenged. They continue to be challenged. How do you figure out who's going to be a good match for you unless you actually see the person in advance? And so healthcare for all is about any avenue to get the quality healthcare that you need at the time you need it from a provider of your choice. When I spent all that energy and time working on healthcare reform, I was not working so that people would have healthcare cards in their wallet that are absolutely meaningless. I was working to make sure that people who didn't have access to service could get it from a qualified healthcare provider. And if we have a legislative body that believes we fixed healthcare, then I'm sorry, you're living in a bubble that doesn't exist. We haven't fixed it. It's still broke. It's still access issues, even for people who are immigrants, who are immigrants have a 6-year wait, so they've still got a problem. We still have many, many kids in our community who aren't covered because people don't trust government, so they're not sure if they should sign up and get their kids covered. And what we need is a system that actually is about health care. You've had other people talk about the profit. You've had other people talk about how attractive it is now. Poor people look to health care providers, and so I'm not going to go there. But I want you to really know that there are a lot of people who are paying every month for health care because that is the law, and what we thought we were going to get was quality health care, and what we have is a card in our wallet that pretty much doesn't do anything but take up space and cost us money. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon. My name is Tim Roach. I'm a resident of Corvallis, and in Corvallis, I'm on the board of directors of Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates. Statewide, I serve as a member of the board for Healthcare for All Oregon. I represent faith communities on that board. It's my privilege to address you in support of Senate Bill 631. I'm an ordained Presbyterian minister and have been for over 40 years. During my 40 years of active ministry on the East Coast, it was my privilege as well as my professional responsibility to journey with individuals and households into our country's healthcare system. I sat beside innumerable beds, held the hands of patients and family members as the struggle for health and life itself transpired. I offered prayers for healing, for strength, as well as for consolation. Through it all, you could say I developed an empathy for those who are caught in the clutches of our country's healthcare system. That personal empathy developed into a personal passion in 2013, when I spent 4 consecutive months in the stem cell transplant unit at OHSU with my wife, as she was being treated for a blood disorder and ultimately died from that disorder, myelodysplastic syndrome. My personal hope is that no individual, no family, no household ever has to go through a healthcare calamity. But as we all know, the reality of this journey that we call life involves illness and death. And as many of us here today also know, there is absolutely no need for anyone to not have the health care they need when they need it. And there is no need for anyone's financial well-being to be threatened or lost simply because they've had the misfortune to become ill and need health care. So I address you on behalf of Healthcare for All Oregon, asking for your support of Senate Bill 361, the Healthcare for All Oregon plan. You see, Senate Bill 361 is a legislation that strives to enact one of the primary religious tenets of the major faiths found around the world. In Christianity, we refer to this teaching as the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In Judaism, this lesson is stated, what is hurtful to yourself, do not to your fellow man. Islam proclaims this instruction by saying, do unto all men as you would they should unto you. The Baha'i community is challenged to say, ascribe to any soul that which thou wouldst not ascribe not to any soul that which thou wouldst not have ascribed to thee. Buddhism, Confucianism, Hinduism, Sikhism, all have their own forms of this central religious council. With this universal religious teaching in mind, it occurs to me that I know of no one who does not want health care for themselves or for those they love when they need it. So why do we as a people of moral faith and conviction, how can we as a nation and state continue to exclude a large segment of our neighbors from the health care that they need? While millions in our country and state now have health care thanks to the Affordable Care Act, over 30 million people nationally, according to the estimates of the Congressional Budget Office, including about 337,000 in Oregon, will not have the health care they need even when Obamacare is fully implemented. And there are additionally millions and millions more people who, even though they have health care insurance, do not have the health care they need for themselves, and they have their financial well-being jeopardized or even destroyed by the costly nature of health care in our country today. To continue as we do now through our present health care system, to systematically and intentionally ignore and abuse this significant segment of our population is not only unfair, it's inhumane. It's not just unjust, I'd say it's immoral. So that's the moral and faithful motivation that brings me before you this afternoon, to address you on behalf of Healthcare for All Oregon and to urge your support of Senate Bill 361, the Healthcare for All Oregon plan. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Again, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. If you have questions, I'll be glad to receive those later.
Let's hear them.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Anderson and the member of the committee. My name is Chen Huiji. I am a health policy and international health professor at Oregon State University, and I'm here to speak in support of the Senate Bill 631. My expertise in healthcare system, besides teaching and research, I also volunteer both locally in Oregon as well as nationally for the Congressional HR 676, that's the Medicare for All American. In addition, I also serve as a policy advisor for Taiwan's National Health Insurance, which just celebrated 20th anniversary. And besides, my colleague already said a lot about the rationale for supporting a universal health care. I would like to start by saying I'd like to present a slightly different picture about what healthcare system is about. when a person is sick or injured, at that time, no other social institution is more intimate, more close to the person than healthcare system. And it is through the healthcare system, the person who is sick or injured feel either the warmness or the coldness of the society. In other words, a healthcare system is more than just an organization that delivers healthcare. A society's healthcare system is actually an integral part of the social institution. Through the healthcare system, we demonstrate what is our value. Through the healthcare system, we also demonstrate who we are as a person and as a society. At present, in our society, we treat healthcare system as just like other organizations that produce healthcare and deliver healthcare. And I'd like to quote my colleague, Professor Reinhardt from Princeton, who is also serving in the same capacity as a health policy advisor to Taiwan's National Health Insurance. He described our healthcare system as, we treat patients as both object of human compassion and cash yielding biological structure. Now, let me quickly summarize some of the key problems as I see it, again, from my colleague, Professor Reinhardt. First, everyone know, we still, despite the ACA, we still facing uninsured. My colleague already mentioned. Some employer, an individual would rather pay the fine, which is much smaller than the unaffordable premium. Despite the ACA, our premium remain unaffordable. And the high cost, let me give you an example. In 2014, the average premium for a family of four was $16,834. That figure was 70.6% of federal poverty line for a family of four. And that just shows how expensive it is. Despite our healthcare is the most expensive in the world, at the same time, it produces low accessibility. Again, let me give you one example. For the same or next day appointment for a doctor, in the U.S., in the most recent study, 43% of Americans report they have the same or next day appointment. Compare with, for example, two other nations has universal healthcare. France, they have 62% who can get the same or next day appointment. British, 61%. So our high cost of healthcare not only yield low accessibility, but also relatively low quality. Again, my colleague already presented some of the indicators. I just want to show one more, which is in recent year has been seen as most sensitive indicator of healthcare system. And this measurement is measuring mortality that can be prevented through healthcare. And U.S. ranked the bottom within a group of 16 OECD, the high-income country. The U.S. number is 96 per 100,000. France, 55. Italy, 60. In addition, we also have high administrative cost. Again, let me give you some example. In 2012, the per capita administrative cost of insurance in the U.S. was $631. Compare with that in Japan, $54. Between 1980 and 2005, the administration of health insurance in the U.S. increased 12 times. Those high cost and generate relative low access and low quality give us the conclusion that U.S. healthcare system is not only high cost, but also inefficient. And high cost and efficient together, they also driven people to be unaffordable to healthcare. In addition, our financial burden is inequitable. For all other nations with universal healthcare, their financial burden of healthcare is usually reflected in their ability to pay. Whereas in the U.S., our financial burden of healthcare has little to do with ability to pay, but have everything to do with your condition of health or illnesses. and whether you're employed and your employer provide health insurance. Now, let me summarize what's the potential benefit if we implement a universal healthcare system like the Senate Bill 631. Of course, the number one benefit will be universal, that no one will be left out by because of he or she belong to any category. Every Oregonian and resident will be covered. The second benefit is efficient. That can address many of the problems I mentioned, including high cost, high administrative costs, and also my colleague mentioned about drug cost. The drug cost between 1980, the prescription drug cost between 1980 and 2005 increased 20 times. And that's the fastest growing cost. We have little control over it. With a universal single-payer system, we have the capability of negotiating the drug cost. The drug market follows the international market. The bulk purchase give you leverage to negotiate discount, which is why our neighbor Canada and Mexico has a cheaper prescription drug, even though the drug were made in USA. The third benefit of universal health care is equitable financial burden, that under the proposed system, we can structure the finance so it reflect people's ability to pay rather than reflect people's degree of illnesses. And the fourth benefit, which is seldom mentioned, is the universal healthcare system has the capability to integrate health insurance with health promotion. They can be under the same entity or related coordinated entity. So our healthcare system is not just providing health insurance, but also taking care of people's health. And the last two benefit are related. Number five is innovation. I just came back from Taiwan's 20th anniversary international symposium. And during the symposium, they were talking about new innovation. One of them is pharma cloud, that doctors and contracted hospitals, they can access a patient's drug history. Any doctor, any hospital. And the information is not only passive, it's also active. For example, if a doctor prescribes a duplicated drug, the system will warn the doctor. Likewise, if the doctor prescribes a drug that can interact with existing drug, the system will warn the doctor. Another new innovation related with information technology is Taiwan is implementing My Health Bank. By next year, it will allow everyone in Taiwan to access his or her own medical history. And you can know where you have been. And I'm taking this to example, not because Taiwan has the best information technology. In fact, many of those information technology, U.S. is far more advanced. However, Taiwan has a platform, the universal single-payer system, to implement them. We don't. And so this is kind of a side benefit of a universal healthcare system that allow us to integrate the information technology that we have, but we don't have a platform to use them. By integrating them, it not only save cost, but also improve population health. And the last benefit is accountability and governance. I always jokingly talk with my colleague and students saying, because we don't have universal healthcare system, when I attend those international conferences, my colleague from other OECD countries, they all talk about issues, policies of the life after universal healthcare. And we're still talking about the life before universal healthcare. One of the big issues of the life after universal healthcare is governance, which in recent years has become one of the highest issues among the countries that already have universal healthcare system. The issue of governance is in a democracy, people should have a voice to reflect, to ask what their healthcare system should be. And that seems to be a dream too far for Americans to think about, given our current system. But with a proposed universal healthcare system, we can build in that governance that more responsive to the general public. Mike, in conclusion, Oregon has been known to be a pioneer and innovators in health policy. When I attend many of the international conferences in different parts of the world, my colleague will always praise how innovative we are in terms of health policy, despite many of them have no idea where in the world is Oregon. So sometimes I have to carry a Pacific Northwest map to show them this is Oregon. And I urge the committee to consider the improvement and possibly support for this single-payer systems to continue our innovations that we can show once again, not just to the United States, but to the world, that we can do. And potentially, we can build this system so other states in the nation, and hopefully, in the end, the whole country can follow. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there questions for the panel? Thank you so much for coming. Ken Meyer, Mark Kellenbeck, and Tom Sinsick. Please proceed. Sure.
I'm Tom Sinsick. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I live in Multnomah County and been working in the school health centers since 1990. And I'm here to say, as a member of the Oregon Nurses Association and a longtime advocate for access to health care, I last came in front of the legislature in 2003 to fight for, as Chair Monis Anderson knows, for school-based health clinics. And I'm glad to be able to speak to this committee today for access to care for everybody. I want to just tell a couple of stories from patient viewpoint. And that's where my struggle and challenge is. I want to tell a story of an 11-year-old girl that came to me a few years ago, very depressed, had lost 10 pounds, wasn't eating, was suicidal. She had health, some whatever they call it. Insurance is a bad name. It doesn't insure your health. It doesn't insure you against bankruptcy. It insures nothing except for a profit for the company. So she had that coverage that you call. And but the trick was, who should she see? She didn't need to go to the emergency room. I could have hooked her with a psychiatrist, you know, in a timely manner. So, but the first thing I had to do was find out which psychiatrist in town could she go to. Well, called psychiatrist number one on the list after we got the list. No, he couldn't see her today. Went to psychiatrist number two. I knew a psychiatrist that was available. No, he couldn't see her today. I worked for 3 hours of my clinic time trying to get her access to the care she needed. 3 hours. Is that how I, under the public payroll, should have been spending my time while she had this thing called insurance? Well, finally, came at the end of the day, had to send her to the emergency room. Who did she see? The very first doctor that I called, the psychiatrist in the emergency room. You call that a system? Is that how you want me to be spending my time being paid with the public dollars? Story number two, very recent, another 11-year-old girl. And for those that don't know, a blood pressure of 140 over 90 is considered severe hypertension in a skinny 11-year-old girl. Well, she came into the clinic recently with a heart rate of 120 and a blood pressure of 138 over 88, not quite at the emergency level. She's an immigrant, therefore not insured yet, working to get her on the Oregon Health Plan, a team of people doing all that administrative work to get her the health care she needed when she needed. But her care was being delayed. Now, I do not know the current outcome of that situation, but I know we needed to monitor her blood pressure every day until she got to the cardiac or renal specialist that she needed when she got the health care coverage so she could go. We couldn't simply promise the family, don't worry about it, you'll be taken care of, because we would never know what it was going to cost or bankrupt the family. Third story, different kind. young girl. Mostly the kids are covered now in the state. A lot more kids are covered in the state than they used to be. But in this particular situation, I always wonder, why isn't your child covered? This is another 12-year-old girl, had a number of health problems. And it's very interesting. Why is after you ask what their problem is, the second thing you have to find out is what their insurance is. Is that how I should be spending my time as a provider? Is that how you as a legislative body want me to spend my time? Well, in this case, it's very interesting. Mom was there. We had a good conversation. Parents were separated. Of course, Dad was paying for some of the things on the kid. Well, it turned out Mom didn't want to have engagement with Dad around getting her under whatever plan because it was going to become a big dispute, family discord, who knows what cost he was going to have to pay, battling over finances, and it seemed really, really terrible. It is, as people have been saying here, it's not a system. And the people that you as a legislative body are charged to be responsible for are suffering under the current system that exists in this state. And I'm asking you, like you did in 2003 around school-based health clinics, when the governor at that time completely gutted the budget of school health centers, the legislative body was wise enough to completely restore those dollars and think forward. And we know what school-based clinics are doing for access to care today all around the state. We need more than just that. We need access to care when people need it now. And we'll ask you, we know that eventually, as was said, there's going to be a ballot measure that's going to come to the state that the people are going to have to submit. And I'm asking you all to stand up and be behind and speak loud and clear, and let's get that thing passed.
Thank you very much.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Senator Cruz, my name is Mark Kellenbeck. I have the privilege of being the Healthcare All Oregon Legislative Chair this session and have been traveling around the state and particularly in Southern Oregon where I live in the Medford-Ashland area. Doing so, I've spoken to a great number of people, a great number of organizations, and heard back from them relative to this issue. Also, the movement Healthcare All Oregon has done a number of polls to get a good idea of where the Oregon population is on the issue of universal health care. So while there are a good number of people here, and there are certainly a lot of organizations represented beyond the people here, what I want to report is statewide there is a very, very strong support for change, for improvement, and for publicly funded universal health care. Recently, this last weekend, I was at Kay Falls at a rally of people for a May Day event. And it was a great gathering, and there was tremendous interest in what we're doing and what we're wanting to achieve. So I guess in short, I want to say the citizens of Oregon, the people of Oregon are definitely ready. They're eager. They really would like to see leadership from this group. We realize it's a joint venture, that there has to be education, there has to be participation of many. But we really do want this to be a collaborative process and really appreciate your attention and your efforts and as we go forward and take next steps. The next step for us, once again, will be passing HB 2828, the Oregon Healthcare Study Bill. Very important. Must pass this session. Really appreciate your support for that bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Myers. I live in Portland, and I'm a volunteer for Healthcare for All Oregon, here today to ask for support for Senate Bill 631. In more than 50 years as a healthcare administrator, I'm one of those bad guys on that red chart, I've seen a lot. I worked in community hospitals, military hospitals, university hospitals, large healthcare systems. And when I started my career back in the 50s, I'd recently graduated from Berkeley, and I was an idealist, and I thought I could go out and help people secure healthcare and make it good for them. I soon learned how difficult that was. My first job was in a business office, and one of my first duties was to go up to the pre-op and have a guy sign away his house before they'd take him into surgery. And it's only gotten worse. The problem has gotten so severe because healthcare is not considered a right, it's considered a commodity, and it's sold, and more so, it's sold at a profit. Back in the early days, the insurance was handled primarily by Blue Cross Blue Shield, nonprofit. They had reasonable premiums. They did a good job. But nowadays, there's huge for-profit insurance companies that are making billions of dollars for their shareholders. It does nothing for our healthcare system. They do that by limiting their risk pool, which has been talked about, minimizing their coverage, denying claims, charging substantial premiums. It's just a scam in many ways. Most community hospitals back then were nonprofit. They provided their share of community charity care. Now there are many large for-profit hospital corporations. They target paying customers, avoid offering unprofitable services, and they make millions and billions. Even the nonprofit hospitals got into the free enterprise spirit of competing for patients by duplicating expensive services, avoiding those that attracted charity care patients, ER, maternity care. Under pressure from doctors, hospitals grew bigger and more expensive. Highly specialized services were very costly, but they provided large incomes for hospitals and the doctors. The fee-for-service payment system encouraged overutilization because providers could increase their income by simply seeing more patients, providing more services. When I started, drugs were only a minor part of the healthcare system. But it's become a huge money-making, profit-making machine that stuffs shareholders' pockets and influences politicians' behavior. My first encounter with their tactics was when I entered the mail room when I first started working at the Mayo Clinic. And there were mail bags stacked to the ceiling. And I said, "What are those?" "Those are drug samples." I called up the Drug Manufacturers Association and I said, "Can't we stop this? There's no room upstairs in the doctor's offices, there's no place to put them." They said, "No, we can't stop this." I said, "This is a lot of money. We know." I said, "We're going to incinerate them." They said, "Go ahead." My second example with the drugs was while I was working at Kaiser. We had to put a tight control on the drug salesmen because they wanted to come in, offer gifts, trips, honorariums, etc., to the doctors who used their products. So all of these promotional efforts just added to the growing immensity of the drug costs. It's been obvious for some time that the cost of health care in this country has been rising more rapidly than anywhere else in the world. People have spoken about that in previous testimony. All over the years, there's been efforts to reform health care. President Truman tried it. President Nixon tried it, President Clinton tried it, and all of them met with horrendous opposition from established interest groups and misguided attitudes. There have been some successes with Medicare, Medicaid, Affordable Care Act, but the system is still fundamentally flawed, just as was when I started. Expenses are excessive, and millions have no coverage at all. Meanwhile, the for-profit segment of the healthcare business continues to rake in billions and billions of dollars. The most recent reform effort, as people have mentioned before, is a bill in the Senate, U.S. Senate, to expand Medicare to cover everyone. Unfortunately, our twisted national political situation, this bill's doomed to failure. So many other states are trying to find solutions. Oregon has already made significant innovative changes in our health care, in the way we deliver it, finance it. And the Oregon Health Plan is a single-payer, government-financed system. And it already covers 25% of the people in the state. So why can't we move on? This aging idealist hopes to see every Oregonian covered by a state-funded single-payer system soon. Previous testimony has described why the passage of Senate Bill 631 is important to individuals, families, and businesses, and how it's linked to House Bill 2828, the study bill. So my plea is to give this serious consideration and make it happen as soon as you possibly can.
Thank you very much. I think that the testimony today has been excellent. Hardly anyone has repeated themselves, and I appreciate you all being here. I'm wondering if we have just two more people. It would be nice if maybe you could submit your testimony, unless you absolutely really insist that you speak in front of the panel. That's Lori Benoit.
I'll go quick.
Okay. And Rebecca Roth. Yes,
Rebecca.
Make it quick, just 2 minutes, because we're supposed to be over.
And everybody else went long.
14 years ago, when my son was 6 years old, he ended up getting type 1 diabetes. It's been a struggle all these years, and it was even more so. My husband decided at 66, Lori Benoit, decided that he had to retire, which over the years we'd always looked at to come this point, and we've looked to try and get insurance for our son for many years until Obamacare came into existence. They wouldn't even look at us. My son with type 1, and go, nope, sorry, pre-existing. He finally this year, he went a couple months without insurance, with having dependent on insulin. We did have to take him in. We did have to pay for that. We were worried what would happen. He still doesn't have a diabetic doctor, still hasn't gone to for any medical care, because he's still trying to figure out, you know, what and who we can go to, because he has to switch doctors. I think over the years, I was a mental health worker, worked in Portland, and I saw the same struggle with people who had mental health issues. This issue has not gotten better. Generally, it's better under having something, because we are able to get some kind of insurance, but it's still, you know, having a card without having a doctor isn't going to do you any good when you have to go in and pay for it anyway. And, you know, we're in a situation where if he doesn't get something, you have to maintain a certain, when you have a chronic disease like that, you have to help maintain that person through through mental health, through, you know, a doctor's, through services, as well as through family and support. And that's what I have done over the years, as being employed in the mental health field. Otherwise, what happens, they fall through, and let me tell you, it costs a lot more money to try and keep that person stable rather than to let them, you know, deteriorate to the point where they need hospitalization and long-term care. And I see that, you know, this Obamacare, this affordable care, is just something that's just a Band-Aid that'll get us through. We're struggling. It's still better than it was, but it's not as good as we had hoped. And there still are too many flaws in this system. And myself, my husband being retired, we pay over $500 for mine. It was going to be a wash whether go Obamacare or go with my husband's employer. And we did go with my husband's employer, but still it's costly. And then like somebody else said, you go in, you have to pay copay, and there's still all these other costs associated with that.
Thank you so much, Ms. Ross.
And I hope you support this bill.
Rebecca Roth, South Salem, and I'm against this bill because it puts all our eggs in one basket, and the basket is a flawed human beings deciding on who will live or die. And in every socialized medicine country, there's people who make those decisions, who's going to live and who's going to die. In England, you can't get medical care after age 65. There's a panel called NICE that decides that whether you're going to get care or not. In China, the government decides on which babies get born.
Ms. Roth, can you speak to the bill rather than talking about the other countries?
I'm speaking about single payer. A single payer gives too much authority to the government to decide who lives or dies.
No, it doesn't.
Doctors are already quitting under Obamacare because they're not being recompensed enough for their Medicaid patients. They've been depending on people that could pay them. I've talked to several who have quit since Obamacare came along. We're moving away from free market innovations, and the countries that have single payer government in charge, they're not the innovators. America is the innovator. And there's, for instance, there's Canadian women that come over the border to have their babies because they have to wait too long in Canada. There's people that come.
Madam Chair, yes.
I think everyone is allowed their opinion. We must have respect and decorum.
They may laugh at me, but there are women who come over the border because they have to wait too long. There are people who cannot access the system because they die
your
before they get
that.
It.
No,
she's testifying.
There's people in all these countries that don't access care. There's not enough money to go around, and the government's cut, and the people die, and they're just statistics. And the single payer is not going to solve this. It doesn't go into free market principles.
Thank you very much, Ms. Roth.
In Belgium,
can you sum up, please?
You can kill up to 4 years of age. We need to stop this direction. We're going the direction that the socialists always go, which is government control and death. And it doesn't solve a thing to go to single payer.
Thank you very much, Ms. Roth.
And I disagree with her.
Okay. Any other comments? Thank you, everyone, for coming. I really appreciate it. I thought it was very good testimony. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 631, and we are adjourning on Senate Bill 631, and we are adjourning.